Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the sound. It's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you even more information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Hey, did you know that twice a day, every day, Connecticut Red Cross volunteers respond to support local families who've lost their homes to fires? And the Red Cross has dozens of other types of volunteer opportunities. So stick with us while we tell you how to become a Red Cross volunteer. Then we're going to talk trash with a representative from DEEP and review some of the ways Connecticut is working to reduce future costs for taking out the garbage that could increase by $25 million per year within the next decade. Then we're going to wrap up with a rep from PURA, the Public Utilities Regulatory Authority, talking about the new Wait Till 8 energy saving promotion and many other ways, like paying attention to your utility bill is going to put money back in your pocket. We're going to be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this important word. You can help end the violence. The Women's Center of Greater Danbury is hosting its next series of domestic violence and sexual assault direct service volunteer trainings. They start on September 6th. You can be a hotline crisis intervention specialist, an on-site administrator, a group facilitator, or shelter advocate. All you need to do is go to WCOGD.org to apply or call 203-731-5200. Well, it was back in the dim and distant past in the late 1970s when I got involved as a Red Cross volunteer. Figured maybe one day I'd be able to put shelter management training experience to the test. And certainly just a few months later, the famous blizzard of 78 hit and I was pressed into service using that shelter management training at the Waterbury Armory as everyone was battling through many feet of snow, and had a couple of other great opportunities working with Red Cross back in my misspent youth. But the Red Cross does so much great work. I can't tell you how often I look at my email and see notices from the Red Cross about how they have gone out right here in Connecticut to the location of disasters, particularly fires, and they're immediately jumping in to help and support families and individuals that have been put out of their homes. And happy to say that anyone listening can get involved, because on Tuesday, August 9th, from 10 to 11 in the morning, the Red Cross Farmington office is going to be holding a volunteer orientation. We'll talk more about that and a bunch of other Red Cross stuff with Stephanie Arcangelo. She's on the line with us right now. Stephanie, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for having me, John.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get involved with Red Cross?
Oh, so my Red Cross story starts back when I was in high school, and I went to donate blood for the first time. And then I was lucky enough in my career to join the Red Cross as a blood services communicator just 2 years ago. And this past August had the wonderful opportunity to come on over to our Disaster Services Humanitarian Services chapter of the Red Cross here in Connecticut. So I'm a Red Crosser, very blessed to be a part of this organization and to help people in need each and every day.
Great. So the first thing I wanted to ask you about is, for people that get involved, I mean, really, they can do as little or as much as time permits. But how often do Red Cross responders look to Connecticut to bring volunteers elsewhere to lend a hand versus all the incredible response work you guys do right here in the state?
You know, so it all depends on what type of disasters are going on around the country. I have to tell you that between March 1st and April 26th of this year, Connecticut deployed nearly 30 volunteers, myself included, to other parts of the country, mainly to the South, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas to help with the flood relief efforts there. Hmm. So whenever there is a large-scale national relief operation, the Red Cross, they start locally and to try to fan out to get folks close to the disaster, but then they go across the country and issue a call, mostly because to volunteer in national relief operation, you need to be able to dedicate about 2 weeks of your time all at once to go out there to do that. So they're looking for seasoned Red Cross volunteers who've been working in the region. And for those out there who are interested in becoming volunteers and doing that sort of work, it starts right here at home and gets you the skills and training that you need and the experience here in Connecticut. When something happens here, you stand ready to serve. And if something happens elsewhere and the opportunity arises, we encourage our volunteers to go and live the mission across the country.
What were some of the particular things that you and the Connecticut team were doing back in March and April down in the Gulf area?
Yeah, many of our volunteers were doing direct client assistance, which means that they work with the folks who are impacted to help get them the support that they need, help connect them with community services in the area to help their road to recovery. Many of us were working in the Community Partnerships Program, which is working with FEMA and local organizations to make sure that we're connecting all of our resources together to make sure that folks are getting what they need. We had people who were going out there and doing shelter shifts, so working in the shelters down there while they were open. I myself was down there doing public affairs, which means helping to get the information out to the community and collecting stories from folks about how they were impacted to get people to help donate and to understand what people are going through in these types of disasters and to really tell that Red Cross story.
Yeah, that leads me to think that, you know, there are so many, you know, small to medium localized charities that also are engaged in some level of response when disaster hits. But I guess the great thing about a global organization like Red Cross is, you know, if you kind of learn the process and the paperwork as a volunteer here in Connecticut, it's the same, essentially the same forms and paperwork, give or take, you know, maybe a few local laws or rules that you may have to follow outside this jurisdiction, right?
Yeah, that's correct. What's wonderful about an organization like the Red Cross is, you know, we are a national organization and all of our systems are tied together and we deliver the same services across the country. And so you can go anywhere and be able to use the skills that you learned here in Connecticut. You can go and you can utilize those skills across the country because we all work on the same training system and we all follow the same processes and procedures.
Great. Well, before we break down a number of the ways that people can get involved and help hands-on and really sort of be, you know, someone who may come after the immediate responders but can still make a massive difference in supporting and helping people in their worst hours, let's turn our attention just for a few minutes to your former career in blood services and just remind folks here at the height of summer a few things that they need to know about the blood supply situation right here in Connecticut and how they might be able to help with that.
Absolutely. So earlier this month, the Red Cross issued an emergency call for blood and platelet donations to address a significant shortage. It's not surprising. This time of year, the summer, is one of the most difficult times for the Red Cross to collect blood and platelet donations. That's because many people are out traveling, doing vacations, and also approximately 20% of our blood donations come from high school and college campuses, which are out of session for the summer. So right now, you know, the need for blood is urgent. Blood products are being distributed faster than donations are coming in. And so it's really important that folks, if they're eligible to donate, that they do consider doing so. They can visit redcrossblood.org/CT to find a blood drive near them. And all blood types are currently needed. So if you are able to donate, we do, you know, request that you do go ahead and make an appointment and donate blood.
And just a quick brief of some of the restrictions or things folks need to be aware of if they want to come out and donate, perhaps for the first time.
Yeah. So if you're interested in donating blood, the best thing that you can do is visit redcrossblood.org/CT. There's a full list of eligibility criteria, but generally speaking, you need to be at least 17 years of age or older and weigh at least 110 pounds. And then they will go through all of the information with you during your health history, and they will take a mini physical to make sure that you're meeting all of the requirements to donate blood that day.
Excellent. Very good. Folks, if you just tuned in, we're talking with Stephanie Arcangelo. She is with the Red Cross here in Connecticut at their Farmington office. We're talking about getting involved yourself. If you'd like to do something aside from perhaps making a donation to support the effort, if you really want to get involved hands-on, the Red Cross at the Farmington office is going to be hosting an orientation for new volunteers on Tuesday, August 9th from 10 to 11 a.m. Last year, the American Red Cross here in Connecticut and over in the Rhode Island region responded to more than 800 local incidents, fires, power outages, hazardous material releases, transportation accidents, and storms. And we're going to talk a little bit about some of the great work that was happening with the volunteers on hand here in Connecticut. So, Stephanie, as I mentioned in the introduction, it seems like two or three times a week since the beginning of the year, we've been hearing about fires, and while you guys obviously would go out and help an individual family in a residential single family home that experienced a fire, it seems like many of these fires have had, you know, 12, 15, 20 different individuals or families impacted. That must really challenge the organization locally, as well as your network of volunteers.
Absolutely. So basically, on average in Connecticut, we actually respond to about 2 home fires per day.
Wow.
That's the average across the state. And many of those are the multifamily fires. And so that's where you're seeing those larger number of families and individuals who do, unfortunately are impacted by a home fire and need help. So that means we have volunteers who are on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And so, of course, more volunteers are always needed to have those folks available to stand up and put their vest on and be ready to go out to help those in need. We have amazing volunteers across our region, especially here in the Farmington area, but truly across our region. We have nearly 3,000 volunteers who do this type of work each and every day, and they do stand ready to help you and your neighbors in the community if you are impacted by a disaster.
What was the last major disaster that you've been involved with, and the Connecticut volunteers have been involved with more en masse over your career with Red Cross here?
You know, interestingly enough, Red Cross nationally this past year, we've responded to more large scale disasters than we had in the previous 3 years. One of the main disasters before I had joined was Superstorm Sandy, of course, then shortly followed, unfortunately, by Sandy Hook. And so we have been very lucky in that these past 3 years that we haven't had what we would call a disaster relief operation here in Connecticut, which is one of those really large scale responses. Mm. However, you never know when a disaster is going to strike. And so we always need to make sure that we are prepared and ready, because it can happen at any time. And so having folks join us now to volunteer, get that training and prepare to be there and be ready when a disaster strikes is vitally important to the Red Cross.
Okay. When situations arise, like, as you pointed out, 2 home fires a day on average that Connecticut alone has volunteers responding to, is it the local emergency responders, the fire departments or the police who contact you to mobilize, or is it the victims themselves that make the call for help?
It's really a combination. So we are tuned in to a variety of calls that are going out there via telephone or via email systems that alert our supervisors in the area that there's an event taking place. And what we do in that situation is we call to follow up to see if services are needed. Other times they will call us directly first. And other times we'll get a note from the family. We try to be as proactive as possible by getting those alerts and following up to check whether or not the services are needed, and we just stand ready to assist. So that's how we find out about the instances. Mm. And we want to let everyone know that if they do experience a home fire and they need support from the Red Cross, to certainly call our office and we'll be able to assist you.
Great. And now for the orientation that's coming up, in Farmington on August 9th from 10 to 11 in the morning, what are a few of the key volunteer opportunities that you'll be interested in talking to people about?
Yeah, you know what? So the most important thing to do as far as the Farmington orientation goes is you definitely need to register online first, and that will help the process go a lot smoother. The orientation is really there to get you set up and ready to go and answer all of those burning questions that you have. So the first thing that you need to do is to visit redcross.org/CT/volunteer. If you just go to redcross.org/CT, you'll be able to find yourself there. And you need to sign up to be a volunteer, and then you can go ahead and check off that you would like to attend the Farmington orientation. I have to tell you, John, we have volunteer opportunities for almost anything that you can think of, from going out on those disaster calls, to being shelter managers, to working in the office, to working, you know, with our financial development folks on event planning and writing letters and administrative work. Pretty much anything that you can possibly think of, we have a role for you here at the Red Cross. And we're very flexible, able to work with your schedules to make sure that you're able to be fulfilled within your role as a volunteer and, you know, to meet your needs and to meet our needs as the Red Cross.
So it sounds like there's loads of things to do for people who don't fancy having to put on the jumpsuit and the vest and either go out locally on disaster or small-scale emergency situations.
Absolutely. Like I said, you can work in public affairs. You can volunteer with our financial development. You know, you can do pretty much anything that we do here in the office. What's really important to know is that the Red Cross in our region, we are 99% volunteer-run organization. And so it's the volunteers that are here each and every day that help to make the work of the Red Cross possible. We simply could not deliver the services without the volunteers, and we are always looking for more to help us and to join us.
And to wrap things up in the last minute or so that we have, what are some of the other ways that people could lend a hand?
You know, people can get involved. Like we said, if you can donate blood, please consider doing so. If you're not eligible to donate blood, we definitely encourage you to bring somebody who is to donate on your behalf. Of course, like we said, you can volunteer with us and donate that time, that much-needed time. But also, you can always make a financial donation to the American Red Cross. You can do that by visiting redcross.org/CT. You can go ahead and make a financial donation, and you can have it go to support where the need is needed most, support disaster relief, or support our local chapter here in Connecticut. And need folks to do all of those things to help us with our mission.
And you can designate exactly where you want your dollars to go if there's somebody's got a wherewithal for that.
That is correct, and that's all available right there on our website.
Fantastic. Stephanie Arcangelo is representing the American Red Cross here in Connecticut in Farmington. They are having a volunteer orientation at their office at 209 Farmington Avenue Tuesday, August 9th. From 10 to 11 a.m., consider getting involved. The American Red Cross shelters, feeds, and provides emotional support to victims of disasters, supplies about 40% of the nation's blood, teaches skills that saves lives, and provides international humanitarian aid, as long as support to many military members and their family. Lots to do. If you'd like to register to be a volunteer and head out to that orientation, go to redcross.org/CT/volunteer, or for any other information about how you can help locally, it's just redcross.org/CT. Thank you, Stephanie, for being part of the program today. Great information. Well, the rest of our program this morning is going to focus on ways to save money. Later on, we're going to be talking with someone from Connecticut's Public Utility Regulatory Authority about Energize CT and their Wait Till 8 program. But another way that folks spend money certainly is on property taxes. And I was recently informed that taking out the garbage here in Connecticut could cost residents and the cities and towns where they live, as well as businesses, about $25 million more per year within the next decade unless steps are taken to reduce the volume of waste and increase recycling. Of course, there's always the issue of helping to protect our environment that comes into play as well. And so we've been lucky to tap an expert on the subject with Connecticut's Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, DEEP. We've got Lee Sawyer on the line. He's project manager for the Bureau of Materials Management and Compliance Assurance at DEEP. We won't be whipping that title out too many times in the course of our interview this morning. But suffice to say, Connecticut's kind of in a good place because they have just produced a brand new comprehensive materials management strategy for Connecticut, and we're on with Lee to talk about it. Lee, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, John. Thank you for the opportunity to come on your program and talk some trash.
Yeah, we joke about talking trash, but man, $25 million a year for just this tiny little state of Connecticut to get rid of its garbage is a daunting prospect when you look at how much folks in cities and towns across Connecticut are already paying in property taxes, maybe in some cases on top of also having to reach into their pockets and pay for their own private waste and or recycling collections. So your report is something that has hit the books at a critical time. Let's talk first about you and your department and how you got engaged to sort of be the point guy for this materials management strategy.
Sure. Well, here at DEEP, we have a role in helping to, you know, to the best that we can, coordinate with local governments and businesses and individual residents and others to help make positive changes in our materials management system, to help promote greater recycling, to make sure that we have newer technologies coming online to replace waste energy plants and other technology that we'll be phasing out. So my role really is help coordinate our planning process here. We have a state goal that was established through legislation to divert 60% of materials from disposal. So that means that 60% of materials that are discarded, instead of going to a waste energy plant to be burned for electricity or going to a landfill, they would be recycled or used for some other higher use. So that's what this plan is really about, is setting a very focused statewide strategy to get to that 60% diversion goal by 2024.
Where are we at today?
Well, right now we recycle about 35% of materials, which is about consistent with the national average. When we look at 60% diversion, though, we're not just looking at the recycling rate. We're also looking at reduction from a set baseline. So we want to see the overall amount of trash being generated in the state reduced by 10%. We want to see an increase in recycling, hopefully from that 35% number to around 45%. And then we want to see a number of tons of material going to newer technologies like anaerobic digestion, which takes organic waste and food scraps and converts it into renewable electricity and compost. So it's a combination of reducing the amount that we throw away, making sure that we recycle everything that we should, and then making sure that we have the technologies in place to use trash as a resource rather than considering it a waste.
Now, some Connecticut communities are already really getting some traction with the food recycling initiatives, which is just one of the latest things to be going on, along with like single stream recycling and some other initiatives that already kind of put Connecticut, maybe not at the top of the list, but certainly up there among states that are really forward thinking and doing a good job, it seems, at getting more and more people engaged in some sort of initiative, if not many of them.
That's right. There's a number of things that the towns are doing to encourage residents to recycle and compost more. If it's more of a rural or suburban area where residents may have the opportunity to do home composting, many towns are helping promote that, providing equipment or information to residents about how they can compost at home. And then there are some that are beginning to pilot pickup programs where you can put your food scraps out at the curb and actually have them picked up and taken to a recycling facility. There's also a couple of large-scale recycling or large-scale composting facilities in the state, and there are a number of these anaerobic digester facilities that are currently being developed as well. So I think we're really on the verge of kind of a transformation of our waste system, where that organic component of the waste stream, primarily food scraps, but also things like grass clippings, yard waste, and other materials, can be segmented out and used for a higher use, higher than just having them combusted at the trash energy facility.
Hmm. Now, Lee, are these anaerobic centers that are springing up already here in Connecticut, are those public-private partnerships, public projects, or are they all private now?
The facilities that are currently being developed are private. So that's a bit of a shift from the way that the state used to build infrastructure. If you look 25 or 30 years ago, you had the CRRA, which is the Connecticut Resources Recovery Authority, was developed. It's a public agency to develop new waste facilities. That's the old model. The new model is to develop incentives for private developers to come in and bring in their own capital and their own expertise to site these facilities. But they benefit from certain types of incentives from the state, like clean energy credits. They can receive a higher rate for the electricity that they produce from these facilities. And there's other types of incentives that are in place to help make Connecticut an attractive place for these types of facilities to come in.
Yeah, and Connecticut was up until just recently the first state in the country to have a statewide mattress recycling program. I mean, when you're looking at the fact that every day folks generate 3.5 pounds of waste per person on average, and you look at something like a mattress that could weigh 30 or 40 or 50 pounds, the mattress recycling component alone has to be making a decent difference.
It does. The mattress program makes a big difference, and it makes a difference in the diversion and recycling of those materials, but it also makes an impact on municipal budgets. If the towns that participate in those programs, the costs of having those the mattresses transported and recycled are covered by the program. So that's what's known as a product stewardship or a producer responsibility program, where part of the cost of what the consumer pays for the mattress, it goes towards the actual end of life management of that material. So it doesn't get passed along to the taxpayer through the town. So that's an example of the types of programs that we're looking at in order to make recycling more sustainable and more economical in the long term for cities and towns are these product stewardship types of initiatives. We have one for electronic waste. You may have heard of the paint care program where you can take back your paint. That's another example. And then there are other materials that we may be looking to in the near future, which, for example, consumer packaging, which is a huge category. If you think about what packaging really means, it's a lot of the items that you might be able to put in your recycling bin fall into the category of packaging. And what you see, if you look internationally throughout Canada and Europe, you see many programs where the producers of those packaging materials pay into a fund that helps cities and towns provide the recycling service and pick up and making sure that those materials are handled properly. So that's one example. That's a big one. It's very, very complicated to work out, thinking about the amount of manufacturers involved and how complex the program could be. But those are the types of things we're thinking about over the next few years, as we want to both increase the effectiveness of the recycling system, but also make sure that we're helping to relieve the cost to municipalities.
Excellent. Connecticut's latest comprehensive materials management strategy was in part developed by our guest this morning, Lee Sawyer. He's project manager with the Bureau of Materials Management and Compliance Assurance at Connecticut's Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. He's going to be with us for the front half of our second part of the show right after a quick break. We hope you'll stick with us. We're going to get into talking a little bit more trash with Lee and letting you know about some of the actions that are being called for in this new report. We'll be right back. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through LoveCT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to LoveCT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Read to Grow is recruiting volunteers for their Books for Babies program inside hospitals in Hartford and Derby. Volunteers work on hospital maternity units to meet with parents who've already received Read to Grow literacy packets with new books for their babies and how-to guides about how easy and fun it is to build children's language skills. Volunteers are asked to commit to about 3 to 4 hours a week every other week. So if you have the time and are passionate about reading and its benefits, visit readtogrow.org. And did you know 4 weekly farmers markets in the greater Hartford area accept SNAP EBT, and that you get more market money when you shop these markets with your SNAP EBT card? Just visit the farmers market at Billings Forge, North End, Homestead, and the West End this week. Use your SNAP EBT cards to get fresh, familiar, and healthy foods right in your neighborhood, and then visit osnaphartford.com to learn more. Thanks for sticking with us, talking trash with DEEP. Lee Sawyer is project manager for the Bureau of Materials Management and Compliance Assurance at DEEP. Lee, how long have you been with the department?
I've only been here for a couple of years. I started out, I had another career before this, working in higher education and actually as a reporter starting out. But I came here as someone who had an interest in public policy and worked a little bit with the governor's office on legislation that ultimately led to this planning process. And I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to stay on here at DEEP and help implement some of the steps that we passed to the legislature.
Excellent. Well, we talked a little bit in the first half of the program touching upon how there's a shift going on in terms of what used to be almost completely publicly funded agencies that played a role in waste disposal here in Connecticut, and how that's shifting to public-private partnerships and even a lot of private participation. But I guess some of the responsibility for developing the trash that's going into the Connecticut system and running the risk of driving our cost for disposal up to an additional $25 million a year within a short time, it also lies with Connecticut companies. And of course, on the other hand, we hear a lot about how Connecticut is quite costly to do business in as a state. But by the same token, it's important, I guess, for corporations and companies here in Connecticut that produce the materials that are going into the waste stream to help share in the cost and the development of recycling programs. Let's talk about how your report is suggesting the state go about attracting and enticing its commercial tenants to get involved at a little higher capacity in solving the problem.
Sure. Well, fortunately, in Connecticut, we've seen a lot of really good progress from a lot of the larger corporations, whether it be grocery stores like Stop and Shop or Price Right, BIC, some of the larger manufacturers in the state. They've done some really good work in making sure that they're leaning their own processes to try to recover as much value from the materials that they can. They have a financial incentive to try to minimize the amount that they're wasting, and they're really taking the lead on some of these initiatives, including in the case of supermarkets, when talking about recycling or composting more organic material and food scraps. They're actually at the forefront of that. There are other businesses that are not doing as much as they possibly could or should, and we have a role at working with local partners to help provide them support, information, compliance assurance, which is basically what we refer to as, it basically means informing them of what the law says that they're required to do, and helping give them some supports to help them move in that direction, provide them some best practices, help them network with other businesses that are doing a good job. So we're really looking at, to the extent that we can, we want to work supportively with businesses that are not doing what they should. We also want to acknowledge the good work that's being done out there already. And it's not just businesses. They're obviously a large generator of materials, and they also are the ones introducing a lot of these materials into commerce. But at the individual level, you and me, the resident, we have a big piece of this as well. So a big piece of our plan is how do we do a better job reaching out to individual residents to constantly remind folks about the importance of recycling and how to recycle, because there's going around the state and frankly coming to this position myself, I was not aware of some of the kind of tips and rules about what you can put in your recycling bin, what you shouldn't put in your recycling bin. It's tough to find the information sometimes. There's no central source statewide of it, you know. Certainly the DEEP website provides a lot of that information, but sometimes it's kind of hard to get to. So we're looking at how do we make sure we have a very clear and accessible message about what the average person can do to recycle more, because most people want to do the right thing and will if they're assuming that they have access to recycling collection and they have the information they need to understand how to do it.
Yeah, and one of the other points, I guess, is, as you mentioned and we talked a little bit about earlier, is really cranking up the implementation of new technologies like these anaerobic facilities that, as well as other types of technologies for the sorting of recyclables and recovering energy and materials of value from waste. It looks like a massive amount of certain types of Connecticut waste going to the state's trash to energy plants are generating a massive amount of electricity back into the system.
That's true. And so Connecticut's kind of unique in the country, and actually it could be considered a leader in the world in terms of having transitioned away from landfills towards waste energy 25 years ago or so, which a lot of folks may not know that trash energy facilities that burn trash as a fuel to produce electricity somewhat counterintuitively are actually cleaner and better for the environment than landfills. Landfills release a great amount of methane into the atmosphere. It's a very detrimental greenhouse gas. Whereas your waste energy facilities have emissions controls in place, they're not 100% clean. It's not that they don't pollute. It's not that they're the ideal solution, but they are a step in the right direction away from landfilling. So Connecticut was really at the forefront in developing these facilities a couple decades ago. What we're finding now is that these facilities really were designed to last, 20, 30 years, and now some of them are, require a greater investment to maintain them, as well as some other economic factors. The revenue that the operators of these facilities receive from their power production has been decreasing. They have long-term contracts that would have guaranteed them a certain rate for their power production, as well as a rate for the amount that they receive to take in the trash. Those have been expiring over time. So the economics for these facilities is changing, and we're hearing that several or some of them may scale back or shut down. And if that happens, which I think is likely to happen, we're going to face a real crisis in the state for what we do with our trash. So because we don't have landfills, which again is a positive, we don't have landfills for your household trash. There are some landfills that take other materials, but not for trash. If these facilities close, these trash energy facilities, we're left with the option of sending waste out of state hundreds of miles to New York, New Jersey, Ohio, sometimes on train cars, sometimes on trucks. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the per ton cost of doing that, right now towns and others pay probably about between $55 or $65 a ton or so to dispose of waste at trash energy facilities. You'd be looking at $80 or $90 per ton or more to send that material out of state to a landfill. So not only is it kind of stepping the wrong way environmentally because of the greenhouse gas impacts of both the transportation and the landfilling, but that's where we're getting that $25 million increase is when we look at how much of that material is likely to have to be landfilled. So what we need to do at this point, we think, is to really invest and focus our efforts on bringing in these newer technologies to the state to make sure that we're making up for the diminished capacity, perhaps, of some of these waste energy facilities. Okay. It's going to be these newer facilities will be cleaner. They'll be more efficient. They'll use the materials for their higher use, And they're also save us money in the long run.
Well, the goal is in the next 8 years or so to almost double the amount of diverted trash out of the system from our current 35% to at least 60%. And many of the ideas about how that's going to get done are part of the DEEP's new Comprehensive Materials Management Strategy. Our guest this morning was part of developing that strategy. Lee Sawyer is a project manager with the Bureau of Materials Management and Compliance Assurance at DEEP. If you'd like to learn more or perhaps review that plan, you can just go to ct.gov/DEEP and check it out. Lee, I learned a lot. Thanks so much for the great information this morning. And we're going to come back around and talk a little bit more with you about this in the coming months. So we look forward to chatting with you again. Well, normally when we're talking with a representative of Connecticut's PURA, the Public Utility Regulatory Authority, we're talking with our friend Jack Betkoski, but we're pleased to welcome a new voice from PURA on the line. Art Marcellinus is with us. He also works with the Public Utilities Regulatory Authority, or PURA, here in Connecticut. And what brought me around to Art was a notice about affirming a new initiative and promoting it called Wait Till 8. And we're going to talk about that and the ways it makes a huge difference to the electric grid and it has benefit to all customers. If you can put off some heavy electrical use until near or after dark, and we'll come back around to that. But there's a number of other important things that Art wants to talk about this morning. And first and foremost, as we wrap up the show this morning, is about saving money. Art was just talking offline, telling me how he recently was able to help one customer in Connecticut save $80 or more off of every bill just because that customer wasn't paying attention to the generation rates he was paying. Right, Art?
That's right, John. Yep.
So
we alerted him to the information on the first page of his bill, and he was able to cut his cost.
And there's probably a lot of people that just get that bill, see the amount, write the check, or click the computer and make the payment, and they may not know that they could save a lot of money. Tell us a little bit about how that all works, because we have heard that electric rates from the local generation have come down quite a bit.
Yeah, that's right. The everyone's electric bill is broken into two parts: delivery of electricity, poles and wires, and then the generation charge, you know, creating the electricity and then providing it through the distribution system. The generation part of the bill is open to competition since year 2000, and Connecticut has over 50, possibly 60 suppliers active in the market for residential and small business customers. What we want people to be aware of is information that's been summarized on the first page of their residential electric bill. For Eversource customers, it's on the lower left. For United Illuminating, it's on the lower right. And it summarizes what you're paying for the generation part of your bill. If you're with the utility, it's called standard service. If you're with a supplier, it'll show the standard service comparison of what you're paying suppliers. And that's what you just mentioned in the intro. People have to look at that information to make sure that they're not paying too much for electricity. The gentleman you quoted was paying $80 more than he would have paid under the standard service offer. So we alerted him to that, and he was able to get back to standard service, which for CLMP right now is 6.6 cents for the generation piece of the bill, lowest rate it's been since 2007.
Wow. So is it a situation where in any given billing cycle that if you're purchasing from a different supplier, an outside supplier, could that number really kind of vacillate greatly on a month-to-month basis? So, like, if I look at those two comparative prices on my bill in June, maybe they're a couple of dollars apart, and then suddenly in July they're like $20 apart. Or are the disparities pretty steady throughout the annual billing cycles?
The legislature took steps to control variable rates for residential customers to avoid what you just described, this spike, up, down, or mostly up. Mm-hmm. So residential contracts have to be fixed for four billing cycles, four complete billing cycles. So again, that's why it's important to look at the information on your bill. Not only does it tell you the rate you're currently paying and a comparison to the standard service offer, it tells you what your next cycle rate is, and it tells you when the contract you're in is going to end. People can save money in the market for suppliers, but they have to pay attention. As you said, you got to look at the bill. And then just and the second part of that message is, if you're not sure what to do, call the Public Utility Regulatory Authority. Call PURA, and I'll just give that number, please, 800-382-4586. Simple message. Look at the first page of your residential bill. If you're not sure what to do, call PURA, 800-382-4586.
Excellent. And folks are just hearing that and scrambling for something to write with. We will give you that a couple more times before we bid Art farewell and get you guys into your music day. So thanks so much for that that tip. One of the other great things that is happening in Connecticut over the past few years is an initiative called Energize Connecticut, which also helps people save money and use clean energy. It's an initiative of the Energy Efficiency Fund and the Connecticut Green Bank, as well as local electric and gas utilities and the state of Connecticut. So, Art, could we pull the focus up to about 5,000 feet and talk about the Energy Efficiency Fund and the Green Bank and the different ways that those entities come into play, both in terms of helping to save the environment as well as help folks save money?
Sure. That EnergizeCT.com website that you referenced is the place to go to not only look for the supplier information that we were just talking about, but the other side of that is lowering your costs through efficiency, using less energy, or possibly pursuing a renewable option, solar on your roof or other alternatives. So the EnergizeCT.com website is designed, as you said, from a view from 50,000 feet. Go to that site and begin searching for the information that you're looking for. It's well laid out. It's got five or six main navigational areas across the top. It gives you information for your home, for your business, for your community, and then the choose supplier option, drop-down menus, and it's pretty intuitive. There's contact information if you'd like to send a question through email, but that's what the site is designed to do, to empower people to make wise decisions about their energy use here in Connecticut, to help control costs and lower the environmental effect of our energy use.
Yeah, it's very comprehensive. I recall checking it a little bit earlier this year and discovering an entire breakout site where you could, if you're going to be replacing, or sadly you've been pressed into having to replace a major appliance, even like a water heater and a furnace, you can compare models and brands and costs, whether they're electrical or gas. It really gets down in the weeds and provides some highly detailed information on a lot of things having to do with energy consumption.
Yeah, that's right. People seem to think that energy decisions are confusing or complicated. They can be to some, but they're really not. This site is designed to give you a resource that, if you're not that savvy, you can call and speak to an expert, an energy, someone who can direct you into a program where there might be a rebate for an appliance or like a water heater, or can provide you. There's a vendor list that's up there as well that's designed to help people select vendors for their particular needs. And the toll-free number for information on efficiency is 877-WISE-USE. I don't have the conversion to numbers on that. I apologize. But if you go to the website, you'll find that. So if you want to talk to somebody about efficiency, 877-WISE-USE, PURA on supplier choice, 800-382-4586. Great people to answer your questions at the other end of that line. Live voice.
Great. We've got a few more minutes left with Art Marcellinas from the Public Utility Regulatory Authority here in Connecticut, PURA, working hard. If you'd like to learn more about all the services and support that organization provides, you can visit them online at ct.gov/PURA. We'll also be giving you the numbers a couple more times to call in if you'd like to find out about whether or not you're saving the most energy on your electric bill. And we've got a few more things to talk about. Art, tell us about the Green Bank.
The Green Bank is an initiative that was started about 5 years ago under the new Malloy administration. It's really designed to, as a specialized function for financing renewable projects and information related to that. And you'll find information about the Green Bank on the Energize site as well.
Very good. And and when we're talking about saving energy and saving money, and you said, and I get this too. People think it's complicated. They got too much going on. They can't sometimes be bothered to learn about it. But they often find out that learning about it is as simple as often changing one light bulb. That's really kind of where it starts, and a lot of communities like our hometown there in Waterbury, you know, we get notices a couple times a year in the mail about them giving away energy efficient light bulbs to get you started, so or getting them to you at a very low cost. So it's that easy and often free to get started making a difference, and that's typically the first step is the light bulb, right?
Sure. And the energy efficiency programs here in the state of Connecticut that are supported by a charge on customer bills, that the website we've been quoting, Energize CT, is supported through that fund, so it's ratepayer funded. And we now spend upwards of $200 million a year on energy efficiency. So when you walk into one of the big box retail stores and you see a discount on an LED bulb, that's being funded through ratepayer supported programs administered by Eversource and UI. But we lead the nation. We're one of the top six states in the savings that we achieve through our energy efficiency programs. One other thing I want to mention, too, is about, you know, people understanding how some of this stuff works. On the supplier choice side, if people go to our website, we have we do outreach presentations out of the PURA. Any group of 10 can get a hold of us through that link. And set up, we just did one yesterday in Bolton. We spoke to a group of senior citizens. We encourage them to bring their electric bill. We'll walk you through the process. When people are done, we are generally well-received for this information people are craving. And our staff that answers the phone actually goes out and does the same service. They serve double duty out of PURA.
Fantastic. And you know, also playing an important role when people are out there selecting or shopping for or considering a whole raft of different types of appliances is looking for that Energy Star stamp, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's become very common. I mean, everyone, it rolls off of people's tongues now, whereas it was introduced a couple decades ago. It's now a very common standard. And manufacturers strive for that because they want to brand their product as being Energy Star just for that reason. It gives them a place in the market.
Excellent. So as we get close to wrapping up here for the morning, Art, the reason that brought us to you in the first place, and that is reminding people about this brand new program for this summer, but that I've heard about before, called Wait Till 8. Tell us what we need to know and why we need to wait till 8.
Wait till 8 is just a message to remind people about our peak electric demand, the time of day when we use the most electricity, noon to 8 p.m. on weekdays, generally during the summer, mid-May through mid-September. Peak demand drives the need to create power plants that stand ready to serve relatively few hours of the year, so the cost for those plants and the infrastructure that supports it gets embedded in everybody's rates. If we could delay construction or avoid construction of those facilities, we could help to lower our cost. Also, when you run those plants, they're all fossil fuel plants because they have to be able to start quickly, shut down, so they run on jet fuel or other fossil fuels. Mm. It affects air quality. You know, we're in the middle right now of an extended heat wave, so the message is, We don't mean strictly wait till 8 p.m. It's just a reminder because it, you know, kind of rhymes a little bit. But early in the morning for things like pool pumps, dishwashers, clothes washers and dryers, things that use a lot of electricity, if you can change your habits for things that don't affect your comfort, we'd ask you to do it early morning, later in the day, all day on weekends is off peak. We don't want to have people do without air conditioning. We're not asking them to shut that off. But if they feel compelled to help with air conditioning, turn the temperature up a degree or two during that peak time that helps with those things as well, cost and air quality.
And while we're on the subject of you know, using the systems that are available, do you have a lot of experience, or can you talk a little bit about this sort of smart house movement and these smart thermostats and how they make it so much more easy for people who may have, you know, maybe they forgot to turn down the thermostat in the morning, but if they have a smart thermostat, then once they get to the beach or to work or out on vacation somewhere, they can just pick up their mobile device and make that thermostat work?
Sure. We're trying to make technology work for energy efficiency and lowering energy consumption. And just what you said, if you are a technical enough that you have something that you can operate a thermostat from your phone, you can be driving home, not while you're driving, of course, but you could be on your way home and you can tell the thermostat to turn on, to have the air conditioning come on. It was off during the day, allowed the house to warm up a little bit. You can drop the temperature remotely. You walk in and your house is cooled instead of keeping it cool all day long. Programmable thermostats are the same kind of thing. It takes a little bit of human intervention out of the decision-making. You program it to come on, say, let's say it's in the wintertime. You want to have it start heating at 5 in the morning because you roll out of bed at 6. You leave the house at 7:30. So 8 o'clock, you program it to cycle down, and the reverse on the other end when you're coming home, if your lifestyle is such that you can program it that way. But those kinds of things are, again, it takes the human element out of it. Real quick example is lighting. A lot of people see occupancy sensors now. In my building at the 10 Franklin Square in New Britain, we cut consumption by 17% because lights go off when people leave the building. 20 minutes, the lights shut down. If the custodial staff is cleaning up, they come on for the period that the custodial staff is in the area. 20 minutes later, they go off. Huge savings. And those types of occupancy sensors are available to commercial customers through the energy efficiency programs. Again, back to Energize CT, check it out for your business or for your home and see if they have programs available that can help you with those kinds of technologies.
Right. So we'll leave you with an important website, energizect.com, where you could go to their dashboard and really go crazy. You could spend hours exploring all the different ways to save money on your energy and power consumption. And also, do not hesitate to call for support from Art Marcellinus and his colleagues at the Public Utility Regulatory Authority. Toll free here in Connecticut, 800-382-4586, especially if you want some help in finding out whether or not you're paying too much for your electrical generation. Art, a very, very good conversation this morning. Learned a lot, and I know that the folks listening did too. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voket@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voket, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one-coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location while supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.